Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm in Vermont, a producer of award-winning handmade cheese from goat and cow milk. For more information, visit considerbardwellfarm.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to
Fun Man About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts to this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right. So we got to recap our weekend first and give some shout out. So as some of you who have listened to our recent shows, we were talking about Tara Witsit and her fermentation bus, Fermentation on Wheels. So she was in Prospect Heights this weekend on both Friday and Saturday.
Outside bitterandesters.com. It's a great home store. We love and we support them. That's what I had to say about that.
Anyway, so we stopped by Friday night. They actually had a beer share, homebrew share at Bitter and Esther's, and then Tara had her bus open. So that was a lot of fun. A lot of people came. We had some really interesting, we had a pecan pie beer.
Incredible, actually.
Who made that?
Bobby B., one of the Bitter and Esther's newest homebrewers. And the way this was made, it was made with pecan and graham cracker. So they made the beer first. They made the beer first, and they made it with pecans and graham cracker in the mash. There was also lactose in the beer. Then they made the pecan pie with a little bit of that beer. And then when it came time to serve the beer, they served the pie, the beer, and also a reduction of the beer into this kind of caramel sauce. And so it was this crazy, cyclical, delicious bomb of 8.3% pecan pie beer.
Yep, it was delicious. There was a lot of delicious beer. Anyway, so it's always great to see how active and energetic and enthusiastic and awesome the homebrewing community is. Saturday, we returned back to Bitter and Esther's. Bitter and Esther's did a series of workshops, and then Tara had some workshops on her bus, as well as having, you know, open times to the public on the bus. So I actually ended up teaching a short mead workshop
you
at Bitter and Esther's.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that was super fun. It was also great to see some people that we have met through other either fermented classes that I've taken in New York City or other Ferment, Zach from Ferment, Ferment.
Yep. And following that, we went on to have a natural wine tasting. And I'm bringing that up, Mary, you're shaking your head right now, but there's been a man I've wanted to get on the show for a while, a guy named Matt Penman, who is a great bass player. You might know him here in New York. But he gets together once a year, and he gets a little kiddie swimming pool into his living room, and he gets a ton of wine grapes. And him and his friends, they just start stomping on wine grapes, and they let them naturally ferment. And we're going to talk about that when I get him in here, hopefully after Thanksgiving.
Yeah. So maybe we'll delve more into some wine because we had, so it was an all natural wine tasting and it was very interesting.
But what's happening today?
Well, today we're very excited to have a special guest, Leda Meredith.
Leda
who
Meredith.
Is author of
Preserving Everything,
her newest book, and then also Northeast Foraging. And how did you meet Leda?
I would say that Mary dragged me there, but but it's not true. I enthusiastically joined Mary at the Sheep and Wool Festival.
The Dutchess County Sheep and Wool Festival. So it's New York State Sheep and Wool Festival.
And they have a llama parade at 2 p.m., which is awesome. It's totally worth going to. Okay, I tired out a little bit. But also, we went to the book area, and I wanted to see, we've been very into foraging or talking about it and things like. And Leda was doing a talk on foraging and how it's good for everything. But we talked about the background of that. We're not going to start there today. We're going to talk about that at the end. We want to talk about what you're into now, which is preserving everything. That is quite the audacious title that you say so in the intro of this book.
I
do. What do you mean preserving everything?
I mean preserving everything. Basically, instead of being just a bunch of recipes, it's about the different techniques and methods and what makes each one work. Like, how does this preserve food? How does this make it safe? And once you understand, like, okay, this is what makes fermentation works. This is what makes salting work. This is what makes canning work. Once you understand that, you can take vegetables, fruit, meat, you name it, everything, and preserve it safely. So basically, it's understand what makes the different methods of food preservation work, and then you can actually preserve everything.
She said can.
I did. I know. Bad pun. Sorry.
So let's talk about some of the let's start by talking about some of the methods of preservation that you talk about in your book. So you have a couple chapters that include fermented.
I do fermenting. There are two big ones. When you say food preservation, I'm still surprised by how many people immediately go to canning, because actually canning is the youngest food preservation method. The other ones have been around for thousands of years. That one's been around for less than 200. And so it's kind of a new one. And then to make it really confusing, there are two different kinds of canning. So which one are you talking about? They need different kinds of equipment. They are safe or not safe depending on what kind of food you're putting in the jar. This is confusing. So one thing I set out to do was demystify, okay, which kind of canning are we talking about? So you can be 100% certain that you're pairing the right method, i.e. pressure canning or boiling water bath canning, mm-hmm. with acidic or non-acidic foods. And this is like a big deal. Pickling is also confusing, because we say pickling talking about vinegar pickling, which is sometimes also canning. And then we say pickling with fermentation.
Right.
And that's a whole different thing that is better not canned, because you want all those happy, healthy probiotic bacteria in there. And that's a little confusing. So I set out to demystify those and kind of separate them out, okay, here's what this method is. Here's what this method is. This is what makes this one safe, that one safe, and here's how you do it.
Awesome. And then the chapters that were that pertain to fermentabot, although I could safely say these kind of all, everything revolves around, everything is in some way associated with fermentation, let's just say, or use of fermentation. We cover a lot of stuff. But you specifically go over lactofermentation,
yeah.
with vegetables and fruits.
Yeah.
And then you also go over some dairy, and then you have some alcoholic beverages too. Some really great alcoholic beverages.
Yeah, especially the raspberry cordial.
sounds awesome. So what are your favorite types of preservation?
I don't have a favorite type per se. It depends on the food that mm-hmm. I'm trying to preserve, because I find certain foods are just better preserved certain ways than others. So, for example, if I have green beans, I'm not going to can them, because honestly, pressure canned green beans are exactly like the ones in the can at the store. They're mushy and not very interesting, and why would I do that? So I'm probably going to pickle them in some way, fermented or not, that doesn't involve a pressure canning process, so they keep their texture. Or I might dry them, or I might salt them, or like there are just other things I can do that are better than mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. So as far as like what's my favorite food preservation method, show me the food and I'll tell you what my top like two food preservation methods are for that food. And it varies from ingredient to ingredient.
Awesome. Well, let's talk about actually, because before we went on air, when we were just chatting in the studio, we were talking a little bit about the food right now. So kind of what's available right now. We've just hit cooler temperatures in New York City specifically. So our selection of vegetables and fruits and everything is getting a little bit slimmer,
right.
more restricted. So what, for example, are you doing this fall?
So fall is apple season, and fall is winter squash, pumpkin, butternut squash, all of those things, cranberries, obviously. Pears are still – quinces are fun to play with right now. All of those fruits are in season right now. Vegetable wise, we're going to be in root vegetable land from now till about April in this region. And one of the things that I like to do with food preservation is not just let's be real. I live in New York City. It's not like I have to put up enough to get through the winter or I'm not going to have any food. Okay, there's food 24/7. But if I want to keep it local, and that's a lot of things that affects my environmental footprint, my carbon footprint, you know, all that stuff, health, local economy, you know, you name it. So if I want to eat locally raised foods in a cold winter climate, which New York is, I either have to do some food preservation myself or buy stuff that somebody else preserved. Or I have to have a really boring diet, because at a certain point from now through April, you go to the farmer's market and it's the same thing every week at this time of year. You're going to see apples. You're going to see cabbage. You're going to see root vegetables over and over and over. But if I take, like I have an apple fermented salsa recipe in the book, that's really fun and really spicy and interesting and a totally different taste. So if in January all I can get at the farmer's market for fruit are apples, they don't have to be the same old apples, because I can make that fermented fruit salsa.
You don't just
salsa.
Have to make apple pie.
You don't just have to make apple pie. You can make that fermented apple salsa and get a totally different taste. And so it is about your carbon footprint. It is about your health. It is about all of that wonderful stuff. And it's also just about variety. About mm-hmm. making the local stuff taste good at any time of year.
Mm-hmm. And even, like, I love apples, but I love them more in September than I do in January.
They get mushy.
Exactly.
They start to get mushy. They start to lose their crunch. You know, they become storage apples as opposed to freshly picked apples. And then they are great in applesauce and apple butter and other things. So it's just pairing, like, the right ingredient at the right time, mm-hmm. like with the apples, to the method, and using it partly so that you have these ingredients year round. I love having blueberries from the freezer in January. That's great. But it's also partly just to mix it up a little bit and have some variety.
So let's talk about, because the apple salsa that you mentioned is lacto-fermented.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, when they think of lacto-fermented, they think vegetables. And they're a little bit intimidated or, yeah. you know, a little nervous about doing that with fruit. So let's talk a little bit about the difference in lacto-fermentation with fruits and vegetables, or is there a difference?
There is no difference. Honestly, those healthy probiotic lactobacillus bacteria are on the fruits just as much as they are on the vegetables, so there's actually not a difference in process. Mm-hmm. You're essentially doing a salt, in most cases, you're doing a salt brine, which kills off any harmful bacteria, and the salt-tolerant bacteria survive and thrive and take over and start working on the food and fermenting it, and that's where you get your ferment. But in terms of people getting nervous about it, I'd like to point out that traditional Korean kimchi is a lacto-fermented food, and you throw a raw fish into the pot.
Or oysters sometimes.
Or oysters. So if you want to talk about, like, you know, being nervous between vegetables and fruits, throw in a raw fish and yeah. see how that goes.
Now, the apple, do you recommend, like, for your apple, for the lacto-fermented apple salsa, do you recommend a starter? Or typically, what do you like to use?
In my recipe, I do put in some optional whey. Mm-hmm. And the whey, people look and they're like, I don't, you know, where do I buy that? You don't have to buy it. You get some yogurt from the store. If you strain it through a coffee filter and, you know, a cloth filter or anything, that clearish yellow liquid that drains away, that's whey. Mm-hmm. And it's full of live bacteria that will kickstart your ferment. So that doesn't have to be complicated. I recommend that because, especially in winter, it's funny, people think, oh, winter is the season for sauerkraut and this and that and the other. Well, yeah, if you live 200 years ago in a farmstead in Germany, but if you live in a heated contemporary building, it's probably 70-something in your home. It's not colder in winter than it is in summer, necessarily. And so that extra little kickstart from the whey actually helps with the fermentation.
Mm-hmm. Cool. What were you going to ask before I interrupted?
I was going to ask, the length of preservation. When we're talking about preserving things and we're talking about these things, in the intro of your book, you also talk about how people are very daunted by preserving everything and because they think it might be very dangerous, and you just spoke to that a little bit. But what is the general length of a good preservation? And you talk about pH. How important is that?
Yeah, their pH is hugely important. pH determines which food preservation method you can use. So if I, those green beans, for example, if I take pickled green beans that I did a vinegar brine with, or even that I lacto-fermented and that have ended up with an acidic pH, I can safely either just store those in the fridge or a cool place, or I can can them for a very brief time in a boiling water bath, which requires no special equipment. It's basically a big pot of water, and I'm fine. But if I were to take those exact same green beans and not ferment them or not do a vinegar brine and just do like green beans and water, like the equivalent of what you get in a, you know, can of green beans at the store, I cannot do that in a boiling water bath safely. The pH is not acidic enough for me to do that. I have to have a special piece of equipment called a pressure canner. And then I can do that, and I can do just plain vegetables and water. And so the pH is key, because the pH tells you which can I do boiling water bath canning? Do I have to do pressure canning? Like, it literally dictates which food preservation method is going to work for you. And then as far as how long, that is actually more a matter of quality than safety. Okay. So if I can some pickles or even a jam or something, it's going to be safe after a year. But the quality is going to start to decline. The taste is not going to be as good. The texture is not going to be as good. It's going to, the color is going to start to go off. It's still safe, but it's just not going to be good.
Kind of like drinking an old beer.
There you go.
Still good, still safe.
Well, sometimes still
sometimes, depending on the style. But how about an old IPA?
Right, but not that good.
Session it. Yeah, exactly. Right. And just, I want to go back, because I know sometimes people who aren't as sciencey. So when we're talking about pH, we're talking about the acidity or the basic, right, you know, how basic or acidic a solution is. So a low pH means that it's acidic. And then that's why there are many bacteria that can be dangerous to humans that cannot live in a low pH or a very acidic solution. So that's why.
This is why, okay, people, rightly so, because you're talking food safety and you're talking about something that, you know, it could be dangerous if you don't get
this
it right.
Is life or death.
Right. This is life or death. So you, but
occasionally, yeah.
Okay. But here's the thing: the harmful bacteria. If you're talking about, you know, botulism, if you're talking about the E. coli, if you're talking about the big nasty could kill you kind of thing, they're prima donnas. Those bacteria, they're total prima donnas. So they need a certain temperature. They don't like it too cold. That's why your freezer works. They don't like it too hot. That's why pressure canning works. They don't like it too acidic. That's why pickling and fermenting works. They don't like it too alkaline. That's why salting food works. They have this very narrow, they need moisture. That's why dehydrating works. So there's this very narrow little ambient situation that they need, which is moist, not too alkaline, not too acidic, not too hot, not too cold, you know, and that's where those bacteria can live. If you shift any of those factors to something slightly more extreme, they're gone. They're history. They can't survive it. And so, that's what food preservation is.
So you're safe.
Yeah.
And so that's the demystifying.
That is the demystifying thing.
And the thing is, even so, like, even when we talk about not the bacteria that would potentially do you serious harm, just that would cause off flavors or off aromas. Right. That's, you know, why, again, the same thing, like all these
same
factors, you know, all these bacteria and even yeast need, they like certain conditions. So,
well, they're alive. So they need like, kind of like we do, we need, we need moisture, and we need, you know, we can't survive below a certain temperature, above a certain temperature, and, you know, we're not that different, actually. And you just create a situation where they can't live.
Right.
And that's food preservation, essentially.
All right.
On that note, we're taking a break.
Foment about it.
Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm.
Spanning the rolling hills of Vermont's Champlain Valley and easternmost Washington County, New York, 300-acre Consider Bardwell Farm was the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, founded in 1864 by Consider Stebbins Bardwell himself. Rotational grazing on pesticide-free and fertilizer-free pastures produces the sweetest milk and the tastiest cheese. All of their cheeses are aged on the farm in their extensive system of caves.
Consider Bardwell Farm is also a big supporter of Heritage Foods USA's No Goat Left Behind program. No Goat Left Behind is a serious effort launched in 2011 by Heritage Foods USA, designed to introduce goat meat to American diners and provide a sustainable end market for dairy animals.
For more information, please visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Severa Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to For Men About It on heritageradionetwork.org. This is our 97th episode here in the studio. We are very, very excited to welcome Leda Meredith of Preserving Everything and for Northeast Foraging, and the other two names I forgot.
The Locavore's Handbook.
Yes, yes, yes.
And Botany Ballet and Dinner from Scratch, which is if you want to know how a former ballerina ended up teaching food preservation and foraging, that's that one. Yeah.
Then till now. Before we go on to foraging, we want to talk about a couple of very intriguing recipes in this book, Preserving Everything. Mary, yes. You had them selected. You were ready.
I know, because they were going to automatically move into foraging. See, it's just natural.
It's
you didn't even have to say that.
Oh, well, it's too late now. It's totally disrupted the flow. It's my fault.
No, so you have, as I mentioned before, you have a beverage recipe, and some of these beverages are preserved in existing alcohol, and then you have a few that are fermented. So we have a raspberry cordial, which looks absolutely delicious, an elderflower champagne, and a dandelion wine. So those are some of my favorites. I love fermenting anything. Well, these are particularly, I mean, elderflower.
Those are my three favorite. I have done many, many homemade wines and meads and things, and those are just my top three that are always in the pantry, no matter what.
Although you have a violet syrup in here. Now, wait, which?
The violet syrup is cool, but that's not alcoholic.
Right.
That's a different thing.
I'm totally entranced, because you could turn that into alcohol.
You could turn that into alcohol.
You could take the syrup and
you would have a naturally blue cordial.
I bet it's probably still good.
Dude, I totally want to. Next spring, we must find violence. I'm making a violet fermented
I'm glad you changed
alcohol
that to violet
beverage
instead of violets.
So let's talk about foraging. Because
okay.
So
let's talk about ballerina and grandmother. And let's start at the beginning. First of all, we never talk about who you are. Why are you on the show? What brought us here?
Wait, who am I? All right, the question, how did you start foraging for wild edible plants? How did you start food preserving? Where did you learn this stuff? When I was a little girl, I lived in a house with four generations of women. It was me, my mom, my grandma, and my great-grandma.
Wow.
And don't ask about where the guys were. That's in my first book. It's a whole other thing. Anyway, and we lived across the street from San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. And my great-grandmother was from Greece, where it's still, to this day, part of the culture. Like, you see teenagers out with their grandfathers picking wild greens in the hills in the spring. And so she thought nothing at all of – she didn't know the word foraging. She just would take us across the street, and we'd pick dandelion greens, and we'd pick mustard greens. And so that was how I started. And my grandfather made olives and made feta cheese, and my grandma made pickles. And, you know, so I sort of started with them. And then realized I loved it. And while I was busy doing other stuff like a professional dance career, I came to New York. I was in American Ballet Theater 2. I danced with San Francisco Opera Ballet, with Jennifer Muller, The Works, with Dances mm-hmm. Petrelli. And the whole time I was doing that, I was also out in the park picking wild food.
But you're on a dancer's salary.
And it helps. It helps. So anyway, I started, but it was kind of a hobby. And then a dancer's career is short. So at a certain point, I'm looking at, okay, hitting my late 30s and going to have to transition out of performing soon. What do I want to do? and this is something I'd been doing since I was a kid. And so New York Botanical Garden had this fantastic ethnobotanical certification program that included wild edible plants, and I was like, okay, that's what I'm going to do. So I went back to school, basically. Please forgive me, anyone from New York Botanical Garden who is listening to this, but basically to get a piece of paper that said that I knew what my great grandmother had taught me.
You say one of my favorite quotes from your talk was there are bold foragers and old foragers, but no bold old foragers.
Absolutely. Be 100% certain of your identification. That's rule number one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And some of those tips, and you don't forage in suburbia or downhill, or rules to that regard?
People expect the city to be the hardest place to forage for edible plants, and it's actually not. First of all, there are plants in the city. We know that if we live in the city. People outside the city often are just picturing like concrete jungle and don't think there's anything. There are lots of plants in the city. And the pollution factor is not as scary as it is in suburbia. Like I talked about at Sheep and Wool. In suburbia, people throw unbelievable amount of chemicals at their lawns and stuff to have like the perfect manicured front yard. And I will not forage there. I will not harvest near there. I'm terrified of those landscapes. I also will not harvest near a lot of farms, because if they're chemically farmed, if they're not organic farms, that the pesticide level, the herbicide level is huge. And so in some cases, it's actually safer to walk into a city park than it is to be foraging alongside, you know, adjacent to a farmland.
And we're not advocating going to a city park and doing this, but...
No, we're not allowed to do that.
No. But that changes based on who's in charge, right? Or, like, as far as, like, how much they were against it. You said something about, you know, in the 70s, they actually printed a map.
There's a book. A book? The Central Park Conservancy in the 70s published a recipe book complete with how to ID these edible plants that were growing in Central Park, and here's how you cook them up. And that's really a big contrast to the foraging is illegal, do not touch thing that has been in recent years. But if you look back, actually, it's fluctuated. At one point, Steve Brill, who's a colleague of mine, who's also been on Heritage a couple of times, was actually hired by parks to do foraging tours in the park. And then he got fired. And so, you know, it's gone back and forth and up and down over the years. I think the big I'm actually happy about that discussion of, like, should it be legal, should it not be legal, because what comes up is sustainability. Like, if everybody harvested in the park, would there be enough to go around, or would we be decimating the park? And what comes up with that is that there is a learning curve. And in Northeast Foraging, in my foraging book, every single plant, I have a section on, is this a plant that's an invasive weed that you can harvest freely and not even worry about it because you're actually helping the environment by taking it out? Or is this a slow-growing native plant that, okay, if you only find a little, actually don't pick, back off. Or here's how to harvest it so that it can rejuvenate. And there is a learning curve, and you have to be aware of the fact that your choices as a forager impact the environment. Mm-hmm. But it's funny because that's just like, to me, that's a little microcosm of the fact that all of our food choices impact the environment.
Right.
When you go to the supermarket, your food choices impact the environment. It's just that when you're foraging, you do it really directly. Like, this particular plant will or will not come back next year, depending on how I collect right now. So it makes it much more immediate and direct.
You don't want to affect the squirrels.
The chipmunks. That was just a bad quote. We'll just call it an extremely, extremely famous newspaper in this city, like the most famous, had a quote where they said if everybody picked their salad in the parks, that the chipmunks would have nothing to eat. And, okay, for starters, chipmunks don't eat leaves. So that, yeah.
Right. But you do a lot of foraging, and we talked on a couple of these episodes back about Eric Steen's project.
Beers Made by Walking.
Beers Made by Walking. And you actually went with a couple of the brewers that made some of those beers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We did a walk, and we there's tons of mugwort. And speaking of sustainability, mugwort is called mugwort because at one point it was used instead of hops to bitter and flavor beer. So mug as in your mug of beer. And wort, this is debatable. It could be wort as in beer wort, as in that first stage of beer. Or it could be wort as in the Saxon word that just means plant. So I'm not sure which one it is. But anyway, it was used like hops. And I pointed this out to Justin from Beer Table, and he actually started brewing mugwort beer for people, which is a lot of – I've made mugwort beer too. I've made yarrow beer from wild yarrow. There are lots of fun wild plants out there that you can use to brew with. I've done metheglins with them.
Where is mugwort native to?
There are two. There's one that's native to Asia and one that's native to the UK.
To the UK?
Yeah.
But we have them here. We have it here.
Oh, my God. We have so much here. it is like at one point the Audubon Society had there's an Audubon building in Prospect Park in Brooklyn, New York. And at one point they had a wall with photographs, like 8x10 glossies, of the 10 most hated herbs that they were trying to eradicate from the park. It was like at the post office with the criminals, yeah, you know,
the
on
10
the wall.
Most wanted.
Right, the 10 most wanted. And mugwort was like number one up there, along with garlic mustard and a couple of others. So I tell people, like, you know, you are not hurting anything if you harvest this plant. You are actually helping this ecosystem. Now, in its native environment, not invasive. And that's often true, that you have a plant that where it comes from.
Or animal or insect,
you know, that where it comes from, there are control factors, like there's an animal that eats it or something else that keeps it in check. And then you take it away, and you take it away from those control factors, and it goes crazy. And mugwort is one of those plants. Mm-hmm. But it makes really, really awesome beer. Careful, though. The first batch Justin did, he used way too much. You only need a little bit.
Yeah. And that's true for everything. I mean, as far as using, I think that is something that's cool. Like when Chris and I went to the Beers Made by Walking Festival at the Great American Beer Festival this year, it was just absolutely amazing. These brewers had either gone out and foraged, often with someone to help them, or they see things along and then they order them from a reliable, reputable commercial source. But I think that's a great source of not only home brewers, but other, you know, fermentationists, like we were talking before about your forage version of
my
kimchi.
Wild kimchis. I've been doing a couple of versions where instead of the cabbage that's usual, like the base for the bulk for kimchi, I'm doing wild greens. So it might be some dock, it might be some garlic mustard, different greens that are out there. And then for the heat, I'm doing garlic mustard roots, which are kind of like horseradish, peppergrass, which are seeds that are in the mustard family, and you ferment the whole thing up and you end up with this very spicy, hot condiment, which is fantastic. And then my latest thing, which sort of does in the probiotic health benefit side, but flavor-wise is really nice, is to then take that wild fermented kimchi and dry it and grind it up, and you end up with a spice, this wild fermented spice that's really amazing.
We have another friend of ours that we've had on, Tony, that dries his kimchi that way.
Then delicious. Absolutely delicious. I put it on everything.
Yeah.
What I love in the book, you know, don't just have identifying it, you have how to eat it.
Yeah. That's important. I also try, you know, it's 120 wild and flavorful edibles. There are many more. I could have done 500 Northeast edibles. We narrowed it down to 120 because I just wanted to have the ones that are actually good. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between edible and good. Right. And there are different kinds of foraging. There's some people immediately think like, oh, lost in the woods scenario. But traditional cultures don't just wander out into the woods and hope they find food. That's really extreme survival foraging. Traditional cultures know their environment. They know their locale. They know their seasons. And they know, like, okay, it's June. I'm beelining for the mulberries because I know the mulberries are dropping. It's September. I'm going for the oak trees because the acorns are dropping. Yeah.
And you said beelining. And one of the tips that you gave in your lecture was, you know, create a map so that seasonally you know where the specific plant you're looking for is, you know, if you tend to find them on your nature walks.
It's kind of like an overlay calendar map. It's like right. the two kind of together. When I teach kids and I do school groups on foraging tours, kids make awesome foragers, actually. And I assign them teams. I get them involved. I assign teams. And I have a calendar-making team and a map-making team. And the map-making team is like, okay, mulberry tree at the intersection between this path and that path, you know. And the calendar-making team is marking down, come back at the end of May and into June, because that's when the mulberries will be there.
Yeah.
And then I have them come back the following year to see, like, okay, here's the mulberry tree. It's June. Are the mulberries ready? And it builds a kind of seasonal awareness that a lot of people don't have anymore yeah. nowadays. You know, my dad grew up on a farm, and he doesn't even know what's in season when. He asks me. And I'm like, I grew up in a city. Like, what are you, yeah. why are you asking yeah. me? But, you know, he's right. It's sort of a cultural knowledge that we're having to reclaim
right.
at this point.
True.
But it'll keep us alive for the zombie apocalypse.
There you go. I think we're good people to know in the zombie apocalypse. Yeah. True. We'll be having beer. We'll be having kimchi. We'll be doing
That's
okay.
That's right.
Yes. Right. For sure.
With that, Leda, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find out more about you and your books, and where are they available?
They can go to ledamereth.com, LadaMereDith.com, and there's links there for my upcoming foraging tours, my books, and everything else. They're on Amazon, they're on Barnes & Noble, all the usual places, but support your indie bookstores whenever you can. So
we'll be seeing you on a foraging tour in the spring for sure.
Fantastic.
And hopefully we can get one together for Men About It with
you. Yeah, that'd be awesome. All right, yeah. Great.
So thanks so much. Again, Leda's books are Preserving Everything and Northeast Foraging.
And the other two that are?
The other
that
two
don't
are
have in front of us.
Right, The Locavore's Handbook yep. and Botany, Ballet, and Dinner from Scratch, which is actually coming out in a new version, which will have new recipes and photos and links and cool stuff on it, videos and things. So,
awesome.
Stay tuned.
All right. Foment About It.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.